Hi everyone, this is Marsha, and I'm the director and founder of the Brooklyn Caribbean Literary Festival. I'm thrilled and elated to announce the birth and launch of our brand new podcast, CocoaPod. Consider the aromatic CocoaPod and how, after carefully ripening under the Caribbean sun, it generously offers up its rich fruit in due season. CocoaPod by BCLF aims to provide a similar delight. Each episode is a seed, a nugget of an original Caribbean story told in the voice of its writer. Each story, an infinite gift by the offshoot of an ancient griot tradition. As a whole, Caribbean stories are like a mighty tree whose branches extend, offering shade and comfort wherever her children settle. The BCLF CocoaPod will burst open with the finalist and winning stories of the 2021 BCLF Short Fiction Story Contest. From my team and the legion of Caribbean writers behind us, we bring to you the warmest of welcomes. The very first stories to come out of this pod are from this year's short story winners and finalists. You'll laugh as two friends mark time and the milestones of their lives as they drink their way across the top shelf of a neighborhood's bar in Rumshelf, confront grief, mourning, and family secrets in distinctly different ways in The Wailers and Bitter Tea, two stories whose reflections on death are as far north and south as the writers' islands themselves. You'll root for a plucky, talented singer who on the day of a very special performance takes matters into her own hands in Singing with the Orphans. And finally, you'll experience the reunion of a daughter and her wildly famous, estranged father who's losing his memory in Daughter 4.
We'll begin with the powerful celebration of sisterhood in The Wailers by Akim Alexis.
Hi, my name is Akim Alexis. I'm a writer from Trinidad and Tobago, and I am the winner of the 2021 BCLF Elizabeth Nunez Award for Writers in the Caribbean. And I'm going to read my winning story, The Wailers. Everybody knows that when you go to a funeral, you don't wear all black. You must slip in some color for the Lord to see you in mourning. If everybody wear black, then he might look down and decide it's just a swarm of black garden ants moving from one place to the other, looking for their hole in the ground. So when Yvette get the call from Baby that they had a booking for a funeral, she immediately set out her outfit, a black satin skirt with a navy blue top and hat, with the blue pushing foot shoe from the catwalk clothing down sale. She heated up the leftover porridge from last night and gulped it down in a frenzy so she will have enough time to comb her hair and sweep the yard before she left. Usually, they got bookings on the day of the funeral because people never consider who will show up for the dead until the cemetery looking scarce and only a handful of mourners show up. Preacher man does say that the spirit in the casket could refuse to leave if not enough people make noise. So that is how the three wailers, Yvette, Isabel, and Baby, came to be. Nobody in these near parts could bawl down a funeral like those three women. They never went into the church building. That was not part of the job. If you want them to shout and carry on inside the church, you had to book days in advance and pay twice the amount. So they usually did their work at the cemetery. Yvette did not depend on the funeral work as much as the other wailers, Baby and Isabel, because she was a full-time caterer, one of the sweetest hands in South. So she attended to her part-time job only when she had the time and needed some extra cash. After sweeping the yard, she went into her car and phoned Baby. Hey, I'm leaving home now, eh? Meet me by the highway, I'll pick you up. Baby on the other end of the call was distant, her voice trembling under a mountain of sorrow. Oh God, Gail, I get some news just now. I'm not able, Yvette, my sister gone. Gone where? Who you talking about? Is that Isabel you mean? I talked to she last night and she said she coming with me to Mr. Moses' burial today. Don't tell me something happened to Isabel, Baby, oh God. No, Yvette. Isabel good. It's Sherry. She son called me just now from New York to tell me she dropped down in the bathroom. I feel so bad, Yvette. We never go America to check she all these years. Oh God, and Lottie just there just so. Yvette went silent in the car. She could barely hold the phone up to her ear anymore. Her chest felt heavy. All the years of disconnect just came together in an instant. When Sherry was part of the Wheelers, she was the loudest and most vicious shouter of the four. Sherry alone could send the casket down in the ground from the power of her voice rumbling through the cemetery like hurricane wind. But Yvette had not kept in contact with Sherry as much as Isabel and Baby did. Yvette learned to love her from afar, but she never forgave her for leaving. 8 years of distant love ending in death. Yvette sat with the news, filling up the car with guilt and shame. That good-for-nothing son Sherry make, he forced the woman to move from she house in Arima to stay in America with he and that white woman. After all we raised with that boy, he just takes she away and say to hell with we. Look now. Look what it come to. Yvette, you're there? I'm not feeling to do no funeral today, sister. We need to sit down and spend some time with yourself. All right, baby. Call Isabel and tell she's coming. We will come back by me and sort this out. Momentary silence ran through the phone before baby broke the gap. We should have visited her, you know. It was too long now. I know, baby. I know. Isabel and baby sat in Yvette's living room, uneasy, flipping their skirt between their legs, shifting their feet to unstick the hot plastic covering on the couch from their thighs. Sherry never said she was sick or experiencing any type of pains. She was always upbeat when on the phone. Baby wondered what type of sickness will just mash you up instantly, leaving you with no time to prepare yourself for God to pull you asunder. Isabel called out to Yvette, who was putting together some sandwiches in the kitchen. Yvette, I know you're avoiding the topic, but we have to go to New York. Yvette looked into the living room from the open space in the kitchen, her face crunched up. I can't do that, Issa. I can't. Yvette put the bread down, wiping away tears before the water ran down at the corner of her eye onto the counter. Don't be so, Yvette, Isabel interjected. I know you're feeling her home, but that was your sister. Sherry's one are we through and through. I could get my daughter to organize the tickets for me. Sherry's son said the funeral is Monday. He giving people enough time to come up New York. Yes, Yvette, baby joined in softly. We need to show up at least this once. Me and Isabel will go even if you don't want to. You will send your love. Yvette stepped out of the kitchen in smooth vexation. Don't send nothing from me. All you want me to go, I will go. You don't think I ain't paying like you, baby? She never even tell me she was leaving. She just went and never come back. You don't think my pain deep like the roots on the mango tree outside? She was no longer in control of her tears. They ran away from her like birds fleeing a rapture. Her voice now a whisper. Don't tell me nothing about sending my love. Sherry always had that. She left with all my love. What else I have to give again? Isabel stood up, her tall body and long neck aiming for the ceiling as she walked towards Yvette and squeezed her arm. I hear everything, sister. I feel you. I will organize and we will go up and send Sherry off. Baby stood up as well. A short woman with strong legs picked up her purse and looked out to the yard. Yes, they take Sherry and carry she to America, but everybody knows she's one of them. When we reach up so, we're going out to reclaim me, sister, and restore she as one of the original four wailing sisters. We will show them burial, she said, walking into the kitchen for a sandwich. The plane touched down on Saturday night at the JFK International Airport. The three women, dressed as though they were about to meet the Pope himself, Baby with her white head tie, Yvette with her brand new yellow dress, and Isabel in a polka dot matching blouse and skirt, all waited for Robert, Sherry's only son, to come collect them and carry them to Utica, where he and his family lived. The home was a pleasant place, hugged by a well-kept garden and plenty of yard space, but the three ladies made no remarks beneath the night. They offered Robert's family the same taut greetings they had afforded him. Well, it's nice to meet all of you again after so long, Isabel said, moving towards the room they had identified as hers when she arrived. I'll just find myself some rest now. It was a long flight, you know. She left little room for debate. Yes, Gil, very true, Yvette chimed in, making no eye contact with Robert and his wife, who were both standing awkwardly in the hallway. "Well, Miss Yvette, I'm just glad you could make the trip. I know it's been hard for everybody, but thanks for coming." Robert measured his words. He knew Yvette saw no need for extended conversation, so he left space for silence when needed. "Well, yes, I couldn't miss the homegoing. Is my Sherry we're talking about? Although if she was in Trinidad, maybe a good sea bat every now and then would have kept her strong and above ground a little longer, some bush tea. But all I don't know about all that up here, so it is what it is." Robert felt the lash, but received it passively, turning his attention to the luggage he was carrying. "Well, thanks again, Miss Yvette. I appreciate you for coming. She would have wanted you here, all three of you." Robert nodded towards Yvette in kind. Sharing a room, Baby turned to Yvette and said, "Meet that the last time you throw talk for that boy. This is not rehouse, and he wife already watching me all home. That white woman don't mean nothing to me. She's a little girl. Imagine that, eh, Baby? You ever imagine America to feel so small? So suffocating? The atmosphere just depressing." "Yvette, that is not the atmosphere. That is you. You suffocating yourself since you hear Sherry dead. America have nothing to do with that. Release yourself from yourself. You hear me?" "I'm not able with all that tonight, Baby. I go and sleep." Yvette took to her bed and turned to the wall. Baby pretended not to hear the cries in the pillow. Everybody wore black. The entire church looked like the pitch lake. Over the years, Sherry had joined the church choir and the ladies' class, so they all wore a silver brooch along with all black dresses to remember their departed member. Yvette, Isabel, and Baby sat in the church in full color, discomforted by the darkness and low singing voices. "What kind of depressing thing is this?" Isabel whispered to Yvette. Yvette looked over to Baby for confirmation of her disapproval. "Oh gosh, Gil," Baby said to Yvette. "I really don't know what to say. God must be sleeping." Yvette just shook her head, turning her lip upside down, furrowing her eyebrows. "Fewer people migrated to the cemetery. Less than 20 people in all. This small number seemed almost worrisome to the three friends. Why did the church stay away? Where did everybody else go?" Yvette walked over to Robert, who was assisting the pallbearers, and asked, "Son, where everybody else? You sure they get the address?" He looked at her in confusion. "Yes, Miss Yvette. We only invited close friends and family for a private burial." Yvette looked over to Baby and Isabel, who heard the answer. "Private?" They all shouted. Yvette felt her bosom sink down into her spirit and the heat from her chest rise up to her head. "This boy must be mad," she thought. In tutus, Yvette's lungs burst open and a loud tumult of soaring pain ran through the cemetery. She held her hands to her head and bent over near the open hole in the ground, shouting, "Whoa, oh God, oh God, oh God, Sherry!" Baby grabbed Isabel's hand and joined in the clamor, almost harmonizing with Yvette. "Blessed assurance, Jesus, Lord God, mercy, mercy, oh God, take one away instead." Family and friends were shocked into sorrow. Robert, who was standing in quiet mourning, covered his face. The wailing spread through the cemetery, turning the burial from a silent gathering to a raucous rapture. And as Sherry's coffin went into the ground, the wailers woke Jesus out of his slumber to welcome Sherry, with Yvette leading the raucous. Because when the day turns, Sherry's spirit will leave this place and rest in Trinidad.
Thank you so much. So I have a few questions. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
The judge's comments describe this as very dynamic storytelling that handles what could be considered very maudlin, overly emotional subject matter and turns it into instead a celebration of sisterhood. As a man, I want to ask, how did you manage, to write from the perspective of three women with such accuracy and authenticity? I imagined that it was one of the the development homes in Trinidad, somewhere down south, that they first received the news as they moved from the living room into the kitchen making the sandwich. It was just so authentic. How did you capture first
because you're writing in, from the minds and the hearts of three women being a man. And I would like to know what your influences were. Like, where did you draw inspiration from for your setting from?
Okay, well, thanks for that question. I could probably answer both of them together, because for me, I was raised among women mostly. My grandmother, my mother, I have three sisters, my aunts, we all kind of like were in the same house all the time. And I went to church every Sunday, whether I wanted to or not, I had to go. So being in that environment, I would have deduced a lot of phrases or linguistic nuances from women, older women in particular. And my grandmother, the inspiration for the three women came from my grandmother and her two other church friends, because they would be together a lot of the time. And I mean, they weren't whalers. None of them went to funerals and got paid for shouting. But they were funny. They were funny women who had always had a lot to say. So a lot of what I put into the story came from not necessarily what I've heard, but how I experienced life around them. Mm-hmm. And one of my grandmother's friends died. Mm-hmm. And from then, that's where I said, okay, well, maybe I could create a story where the characters represent at least three women and one of them died. And then from there, I said to myself, okay, well, what do these women do? And I always thought the idea, I don't know where I heard it from, but I knew that there are people who got paid to cry at funerals. And I was like, well, what is that? So I said to myself, well, I think that's where I could probably begin. And I remember writing on a page, four women wailing at funerals and one dies. And that's where I started. Yeah. That's where the story started from. So I was influenced a lot by church culture. For instance, in the story, I think lower down, I refer to everybody wearing black.
Yeah.
I know that everybody wears black at funerals. I don't know anybody that wears color. So I made that up at the beginning where, yeah, I don't know anybody who wears color, but I said, this would be strange. So maybe I should turn it upside down. So they were rather shocked when everybody was wearing color and singing these very soft songs.
Listen, yeah, and we also experience in the reading of the story, your exposure, I'm assuming, to kind of a Christian upbringing, right? Like you reference the rapture. There's Jesus at the end who wakes up and gets her, like, very subtly you drop that in there. So, that was just brilliant, in addition to some of the creative license that you took, right? Like having people wear color. And these characters themselves, unfortunately, one is dead. Sherry is dead, so we don't really get to hear from her, but they are very colorful characters themselves. Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to know, so actually you kind of answered it just now when you said that you had heard somewhere before that people get paid to make noise at funerals, which is true. It actually comes from an African tradition, right? Which is the belief that in their very cyclical view of the world, birth and death are celebratory. So you make noise, and we tend to in the Western world cry a lot at funerals because it's sad. And in other parts of the world, yes, they are the wailers and they also celebrate that. I was wondering, since there are underpinnings of this ancestral tradition of mourning for the dead in your story, if it was merely coincidental, or if that was a response to the contest brief, because, we spoke about going back to ancestral traditions, unearthing old traditions. Was it merely coincidence? I mean, it's fine if it was, because it was perfectly matched.
Right. Well, it was a little bit of both, because I did look at the contest brief and I said to myself, well, I do need to try and be in line. Mm-hmm. This is what is expected. Mm-hmm. However, a lot of it I tend to work from memory.
Yeah.
And when it comes to religion, my memory is kind of twofold, where my main religion, which is my grandmother's religion, is Church of Christ. So it's very rigid. There's no instruments played in the church. Everybody has to sing a cappella. There's no shouting and wailing or anything. Whereas my great grandfather, he was a Shorter Baptist. He was a pastor.
Yes.
And it was when I attended his funeral, it was the first time I was like, "What is this? This noise?" And everybody was just bawling, and people were like laughing and crying at the same time, and it was. And they had like palm leaves over the coffin, like he was a king. I'm like, this is what I want. This is how the way to go out. So that difference, I drew a lot from. I tried to put those two differences in the story.
So, we got it.
Right. Thankfully. Thankfully.
We felt also, I love the contrast. And then also you dealt with migration, right? And how our identity either is morphed by the landscape or we change the landscape. So we love the contrast between how the Whalers in Trinidad or even how you use their profession to highlight a tradition of passing on in Trinidad. Yeah. But then when you come into foreign, right, into the bigger country, how those rites of passage are muted.
Yeah.
And then they come in strong contrast. And it did not escape me that you send them all, you sent Sherry all the way to Utica.
Yeah.
contrast.
Very, very far away, yes.
Not even Brooklyn, where there are vestiges of.
Yeah, that was really intentional to send her as far away as possible today.
Far away as possible.
I wanted to do that to emphasize why Yvette would have been that upset.
Mm-hmm.
For her, I guess with her son in particular, because he would have probably had a different perspective. Although he doesn't have much lines either in his story.
But you were so succinct in creating that tension, right?
Yeah.
And perhaps either his own cognizance of what he had done and how he had separated his mother from her sisters, who, though not umbilical sisters, not blood sisters, shared a very close bond. So we love the tension that was created, you know, even through the economy of your words, like you you did that really well.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. I mean, and it really, strangely enough, it really took a lot of pulling off teeth, I think, to get that down, because I tend to write in long form, so I have a lot of editing takes place, and I have to take a lot of stuff, a lot of lines have to be removed. And like, this is too much, Akin. Let's just remove this whole paragraph.
Well, there's a maxim that says brevity is the soul of wit, and I keep trying to remember that, because like if you're telling a joke, like you have to be real short, right? Like nobody want to hear you rambling on, or you're gonna lose the punchline is short. You're gonna lose your audience, right? The whole point. But how then was that process for you contracting this phenomenal story in 2,000 words, being a long form master and not a master of the short form?
Right. I had to determine which characters I would give more power to, I guess, when it comes to telling the story or being the vehicle for that story.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided ultimately through women, I couldn't let all of them be ranting on. So I decided I would zone in on Yvette. And I wanted to have Robert say some more things, but I felt like, you know, that would probably be taking the story into something else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I wrote down a list of people I would have say particular things and how much they would say. Mm-hmm. So I wrote out a whole bunch of stuff, and I was like, okay, so no, yes. that's how it went. I think I had a whole conversation in the church afterwards, and I was like, no, okay, this is not it. So scene by scene. I do break it down into scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to work better that way. So I had the scene at the beginning where she found out the news. Then I said, okay, scene two, where she was making a sandwich and they were kind of confronting her about her emotions. Mm-hmm. Then heading to New York, to Utica. Yeah. And then the funeral. So I said to myself, those are like four scenes and I have a word limit. Therefore, dialogue has to, a lot of economy has to be, a lot of pulling on. A lot of editing has to take place with the dialogue. Yeah. So I said, well, I'm going to try to say what I have to say without the dialogue.
It kind of works for the son, because
it creates
that strain, right, and the tension, and all of the things that you want to say but you probably shouldn't say. It suggests to us heavily that they are not on good terms. The Whalers are displeased with the son and his awareness of that. And so he probably just hushes mouth and let people like him, right? Like, what could you really say? That was lovely. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I really wanted to justify why the son would invite them in the first place and actually invite them into his home. But then I felt like I wouldn't need to do that because he probably knew, you know, he understood that some wrong would have been done.
Yes.
And he was trying to undo that. He was trying to undo that.
So do the Whalers just wail for money or do they really believe in what they believe in? Because at the beginning you talk about, their job really takes them at the graveside. And if you want them to come and ball inside the church, that's a completely different story and a different price point. And I ask this because this has really deep roots, right? Like this tradition of wailing, it has a place, it has a spiritual meaning in a lot of cultures. So are Yvette, Isabel, and Baby doing this for the money?
I would say I think off of, I actually spoke about this very briefly months ago with one of my aunts who... She alleged that she knew somebody who did it. So I don't know if she was telling the truth or not, but she alleged that she knew someone. And because they didn't want it to be a mockery, you know, like inside the church, the person would ask that you pay them more to do it inside of the church building rather than outside, into the open air where, quote unquote, the Lord could actually receive the message. And for the story, I feel as though, I don't know if it's because Sherry left, but I feel as though for Yvette, it became about the money. Whereas for the others, it was very much so something they believed in very strongly. And because I intentionally did not mention the other women having full-time jobs. So their job was to wail. Mm-hmm. Whereas Yvette, she had a catering business at the side. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, that catering business started after Sherry left.
Well, it's because if it was, I love the way that it turns on itself, that they jump on a plane and go to New York to achieve the very same purpose that was kind of contrary to their own beliefs. It's almost as if you kind of inverted that. Mm-hmm. And so if they were just doing it for money, how they take this pilgrimage to accord to their sister the rite of passage so that she could be received in paradise.
Yeah, because they believed in it ultimately, because they definitely wasn't getting paid for that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you are a writer. Tell us, you want to tell me or tell us, share with me on behalf of everybody else, what your writing regime is like, where you are in your writing career.
Well, I would say I'm fairly new.
I don't believe in emerging writers, right? Like
I was wondering the same thing. It's a strange term, emerging writers. Yeah. When do you stop emerging? And what is the
where are you coming from?
Yeah, where are you coming from and where are you going?
Where are you going to? Yeah.
When it comes to that. So well for me, I started writing maybe like 2 years ago, roughly. because I was always into literature. So I mm-hmm. did literature in undergrad, linguistics, and literature in postgrad, but I never did creative writing
mm-hmm.
because I don't know why. I just assumed that I probably wasn't a good writer. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And my regime current, because I have realized that it's something that I truly love doing. And
I mean, you're very good at it.
And that's what some people say. So I said, you know what, Akin, maybe you are. Yeah. Maybe you are. We should probably put more effort into it. Yeah. So I would attest, though, to not having a very rigid writing regime. I'm not good. I'm not very disciplined. So mm-hmm. I'm really trying to become more disciplined. I have like a to-do list
mm-hmm.
every now and then. And I don't try to make it too complicated. I don't have to do this by this time on this. I just have a to-do list. And once I scratch it off, I feel good. So if I'm like writing a story and I do a paragraph, yeah, something is accomplished there.
Yeah. A little more gas for your tank to keep going.
Yeah, a little more gas for my tank. Mm-hmm. I do work better at night and not a morning person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more productive at night. So at night, I usually try to turn off Netflix and not answer the work emails, although they come through,
mm-hmm.
and read, because I just can't get a lot of creative juices flowing without reading.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. It's,
yeah.
I have to do it. Poetry really helps a lot.
Do you write poetry?
I write poetry, nonfiction, and fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I only started writing creative nonfiction in the past couple of months, and I really started enjoying that. I have like a piece coming up in The Rumpus.
Oh, good for you. Good job.
Yeah, so I was like, okay, this is good. It actually sounds something that I finished, and I'm like, okay, well, you know, this isn't too bad, Akin.
But you know what? You're too bad is a winner, right? Like, if you think it's not too bad, it's probably pretty excellent.
Sometimes it's horrible, though, but I mean... I get motivation from that, knowing that okay, somebody else thinks that this is actually worth something, I guess. But mm-hmm. I do a lot of writing for myself, a lot of things that stay in folders and marinate there for a while.
Mm-hmm. Is there any one mm-hmm. particular kind of subject that you like to write about? I think that with the story, and the ones that I love the most are the stories that shine light on ordinary lives, because I think I think the lives of the ordinary contain very extraordinary moments. So I those are the stories that I love the most, and I felt like Whalers was one of those. Is there a topic or a theme that you like to write about a lot?
Yeah, I am also the same. I love reading and writing about ordinary lives. I feel as though I know a lot of people read for escape or write for escape, mm-hmm. but there are things that I mean, I do want to escape as well, but escaping from here and going to, I don't know, Jamaica into an old lady's house where she's cooking something is also a type of escape.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And those type of stories for me, that's what I cling to, I guess. For writing, I think a lot of the things I write tend to focus on that, the real life, as well as things like memory, culture.
Mm-hmm.
I have a particular interest in death and the way people perceive death, and the way death is I don't know why. I probably need to look into myself for that.
Well, I don't want to. I've been thinking a lot about death. Mm-hmm. Not in a macabre way, so I kind of understand. Like I think it's so mm-hmm. mystic, right? It's so mystical. So
yeah, I agree, because I think maybe it may stem from. Well, I've always been very interested in the way people perceive the afterlife, or what they think the afterlife should be, or what in their mind, or how people approach the idea of death. And there was this book. There is this book called "Dying" by Corey Taylor. It's a
By whom?
Corey Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nonfiction book, and she was suffering with type of, I think it's melanoma, and in her process of dying, she wrote that book, and she is very light. It's strangely enough, it's very lighthearted and funny.
Mm-hmm.
And she approaches death in this very well matter-of-fact way. And day by day, she just writes into the book her thoughts on everything associated with her dying and death in total. And she would answer questions that I think a lot of people have, like, how does religion factor into death when you are dying? And she puts how she feels into it. How do people who are suffering with particular diseases and suffering badly, how do they feel about dying? For her in particular, she felt as though she should be allowed to choose how she dies.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So she want, so that was something, that book was really pivotal for me.
There's a book that I thought of when I was reading the story, and although it only corresponds with a tiny bit of the book, like the Whalers feels like a page pulled straight out of it. The book is called Aftershocks, and it's a memoir by Nadia Owusu.
Right. I have that on my reading list. I need to buy that book. Thank you for reminding me.
So I'm trying to find a chapter real fast so that you could look at it. But her father dies, and they're in France when her father dies. And she talks about, she's a child, and she talks about the awkward feelings. And she is a United Nations baby. So she's like moving all around the world with her dad. And when he dies, they're in France, in Paris, in the bastion of civilization, if you would, right? If you were. And her father's Ghanaian, and his compatriots, his countrywomen, come to their house, a chic Parisian apartment, to ball down the place.
I love that. I love that book already. Is it?
For the same reason. It's like in the first half of the book, because I can't find a page. But it genuinely, I hearkened back to Aftershocks when I was reading it. Right. And it's a very complex, she tackles lots of other complex things in the book.
Right.
Listen to me, in the story that you've got something rich and beautiful. And I think that it speaks a lot to migration and movement and identity, and also our Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Trinidadian traditions and rituals that are important, that are ordinary, and that are important parts of so many people's lives who never make the marquee of our society, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
It's
thank you so much for that.
And grand. And I love stories that do that. Most of all, I love stories that immediately just tap into my sensory reserves and make me feel like I'm home, whether it's by language or setting or description. And The Whalers, honestly, is a winner. And it ends on such an exuberant, joyful foot, right? Like,
yeah.
Sherry goes to the where she's supposed to be. There's some kind of reconciliation posthumously between Yvette, Isabel, and Baby.
Yeah.
They make it to foreign. They upend this rigid conservative society, and they assert themselves without thinking about who, you know, with a kind of devil may care attitude. Well,
who
thinks that this is too much or savage. They do what they're supposed to do. It's honestly a phenomenal story, and truly deserves the award, the honor of having won this contest this year.
Right. Thank you so much for that. That does mean a lot to hear that. And I'm still very shocked, but thank you.
So tell me how you, when you received the news, like, how did you feel?
I was really shocked. It was because, I mean, I was a finalist last year.
Yes.
And I said to myself, you know, this year I would like to be a finalist again, and that's enough. And then the finalist released, you'll announce the finalist. And I was like, well, I'm definitely just being a finalist. And I've seen these names here. And I was content. There was no expectation, you know, after that.
Yeah.
That was, but when I got the news, it was a very expansive feeling.
You I am hungry, honestly, for more of your writing. I truly look forward to where you go from here and what you produce here on out.
Thank you for that.
You have enriched, you know, our work, and we are honored to present you in this way to the world.
I'm honored to be a winner. You know. Thanks very much to the entire organization too, because I mean you all do amazing work and it's not easy. I know it's not easy.
Thank you. But we just at its simplest, we just really want to build a bridge to move these stories, and if nobody else going and do it for us, then we're gonna do it for ourselves. Like,
do it for yourselves, you know.
Yeah, we're doing it for ourselves. We have really important things to say, and even if it means that we're just talking to each other, that's valid.
That's fine too. That's also
fine, right?
Yeah.
So that's it for me. Those are the only questions that I had.
Yeah. Very good session.
Thank you. I agree.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Akim.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please take a moment to follow CocoPod and turn on your notifications so that you don't miss new stories when they drop. One last thing. Caribbean stories and Caribbean writers need our help. Show your support by sharing and downloading this podcast as far and as widely as you can. Buy their books, support independent bookshops, and request Caribbean titles from your local libraries. Remember that a rising tide lifts all ships. Give thanks. For more Caribbean storytelling goodness, follow CocoPod and BCLF Always Lit on all major podcast platforms.